listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it's the Friday News Roundup. This week, charges for former President Trump, election news from Wisconsin, and a new NASA crew getting ready to head to the moon. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, the U.S. Senate voted last week to repeal two authorizations for the use of military force in Iraq dating back to 1991 and 2002. The vote came 9 days after the 20th anniversary of the start of the Iraq War and Operation Iraqi Freedom. It represented significant bipartisan cooperation led by Democrat Tim Kaine of Virginia and Republican Todd Young of Indiana. President Biden has said he would sign the bill if it gets to his desk, but it's unclear how much support it's going to have in the House. There's another use of force authorization from 2001 that's been used in counterterrorism interventions around the world that remains untouched by the Senate bill. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see the federal government officially repeal that military authorization in Iraq? Why or why not? What message, if any, do you think it would send if repealed? Do you have questions about how this works? What Congress authorizes the president to do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. John Hall is the Ambrose Heseltine Associate Professor of U.S. Military History at UW-Madison. He's a retired U.S. Army Reserve Colonel with past assignments to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and U.S. Central Command, which oversees military operations in the Middle East. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. My pleasure to be here.
Can you talk about how this system works? We used to have, a formal declaration of war that authorizes the executive branch, the president, to take military action. What, if anything, is different about this concept of a authorization of the use of force?
Yeah, well, of course, the United States has not formally declared war since 1942, the very early U.S. involvement in the Second World War. And since the conclusion of that conflict, the world of armed conflict for the United States and the Soviet Union in a bipolar world was far more complicated and contested, and it saw the advent, not that this is historically novel, but novel from a U.S. perspective, a world of constabulary or police actions of the sort, such as the war in Korea, and that was the sort of euphemism used to describe that conflict. Truman actually sent U.S. forces into Korea without congressional authorization. Congress has, at various points in time since World War II, tried to assert its constitutional prerogative as being the power responsible for making decisions of war and peace. And it's done so by granting presidential administrations explicit authorizations to use military force in specific contexts. You mentioned the several of them that apply to recent operations in Iraq and the so-called global war on terror. I think probably the other most famous one since World War II is the Gulf of Tonkin resolution from 1964, which authorized the Johnson administration to respond to a real and an imagined attack, which ultimately launched U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War.
Now, the Senate action from, this is a couple weeks back now, tackled actually two authorizations, as I understand it, the 2002 one that led to the more recent Iraq War, and the 1991 resolution that was after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. I think a lot of people might be surprised to hear that they're still effectively in effect. Why are they in effect? Are they that open-ended?
Well, I suppose they are. I will admit that I myself was surprised to learn that the 1991 authorization had never been explicitly repealed or revoked. And so we might chalk that up to simple housekeeping. I think that the more significant, symbolically, but more than just symbolically, change here is the repealing of the 2002 authorization, which authorized the George W. Bush administration to launch what was later known as Operation Iraqi Freedom. It's not going to change anything on a day-to-day basis, so I don't know that there was a particular sense of urgency beyond the fact that we have, as you mentioned in the lead-in, marked the 20th anniversary of that campaign, and this is about time to clean up the books in that regard as well. We're no longer, and we have not been for quite some time now, conducting that kind of operation in Iraq, which was, you know, an operation conducted with the express purpose of deposing the Saddam Hussein regime and the Ba'ath Party. We haven't been engaged in that kind of operation for well over a decade now. And so the authorizations that have been revoked weren't actually in use. The one that remains in effect from 2001 that you mentioned is the one that more neatly matches ongoing U.S. and partner operations that continue to be conducted in Iraq.
I want to spend some time on that one, but I want to stay in Iraq for a moment. We had the Bush administration negotiating the effective U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. That happened under the Obama administration. Then ISIS came along, and the U.S. Took military action in Iraq targeting ISIS. Was that, in effect, authorized by that 2002 resolution? The Obama administration didn't need to go back, in effect, to Congress and say, hey, we need to do some more stuff there now?
Well, presidential administrations and White House lawyers have a tendency of interpreting their authorizations rather broadly, and I think that's true of both parties. And I cannot speak specifically. I'm sure that the White House lawyers made a particular judgment on that question at the time. However, the fact is the 2001 authorization, which is basically authorization to wage a global war against violent extremism, fundamentalist, militant Islamic fundamentalism, that authorization more neatly fitted the circumstances of the reintroduction of U.S. and partner forces in Iraq in 2014. And so with the repeal of the 2002 authorization and the 1991 authorization, it is that 2002 War on Terror authorization that meets the circumstances and the requirements for both the Iraqi government and the foreign nation forces, which it has invited into its country to complete the defeat of ISIS.
Talking to John Hall, military historian at UW-Madison, looking at use of force authorizations provided by Congress to the White House over the years. The Senate voted to repeal two of them, the ones enabling two different wars against and in Iraq. But there's that still that big one out there, the, in effect, War on Terror authorization. You could join in with your thoughts on that, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John, that 2001 authorization, this Senate bill does not target that. I've seen some Republicans in the House saying that should be included, too. There's been some criticism saying that it's a blank check, in effect, that allows presidents to intervene just about anywhere. What are your thoughts on that one that so far isn't on the table?
Well, you know, Rand Paul tried to issue an amendment in the Senate to the bill that repealed the 1991 and 2002 authorizations of military force to include also the 2001 authorization, and that went virtually nowhere. So there is no strong bipartisan support to revoke the 2001 authorization, because the unfortunate fact remains that there are still viable terrorist entities that are continuing to work to build the capacity and have the stated and demonstrated intent of attacking the United States and the homelands of the United States' allies. And so without that authorization, the Biden administration has no legal authority to continue to conduct or even to support operations designed to further attrit and ultimately defeat the likes of Al-Qaeda or ISIS, ISIS core in the Syria and Iraq, and ISIS Khorasan in the case of Afghanistan as well.
Is it, do you worry that it's too broad, though, that it could be used to justify a wide variety of actions that maybe Congress hadn't intended at the outset?
Well, in accordance with the War Powers Resolution of 1973, and granted, this is a fairly contentious resolution or piece of legislation by Congress, that was an effort by Congress to rein in the Nixon administration, which was famously described as the imperial presidency in the later years of the Vietnam War. And it essentially asserted exactly what the Constitution had asserted in terms of this division of authority between the executive branch and the legislative branch, and provides, I think, a reminder to administrations that these are our decisions to make. And not only do we have the power to authorize the use of military force, but we further have the power to deauthorize it, or specifically tell an administration, that's enough of those military operations, and you have a set period of time to redeploy military forces and cease these operations. That's never really been tested. And there are different legal scholars and different scholars of civil military relations and constitutional scholars who continue to debate this. I'm certainly no expert in any of those debates, but as a historian of the early Republic, I do lean toward the Congressional War Powers prerogative in that debate. As I said before, White House counsels tend to take a more capacious view of presidential war-making powers. The specific point of departure in those debates is how broadly you might read a president's authority to repel a sudden attack, or what a president perceives to be an imminent attack. In the age of SAIL and black powder, that was pretty straightforward. In the age of intercontinental ballistic missiles and submarine launched ballistic missiles, not to mention now the militarization of space and cyberspace, what constitutes an imminent attack on the United States or a warranted and proportional response? That is a very meddlesome sort of question. And I don't think the 2001 authorization to continue active operations to defeat Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other terrorist groups is anywhere near the level of importance of that much broader question about a president's prerogative to repel sudden attack with all of the means that adversaries of the United States have at their disposal in the 21st century.
We're talking to UW-Madison military history professor John Hall about the Iraq War and the recent U.S. Senate vote that would repeal the authorization of military force in that country. That particular vote may be symbolic. That change might be symbolic if it passed the House and got signed by the president. Also, the 2001 authorization that authorizes much of the war on terror. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much power do you think a president of the United States should have to use military force abroad? Do you want to see a more active role from Congress, or do you like the current state of affairs? And we're going to look back at changing attitudes toward the Iraq War. Have your attitudes changed over time? Call 800-642-1234 if you'd like to join in. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with John Hall, the Ambrose Heseltine Associate Professor of U.S. Military History at UW-Madison, retired U.S. Army Reserve Colonel, with us today to talk about the Iraq War and the U.S. Senate voting to repeal the authorization for the use of military force in that country just after the 20th anniversary of the start of that war. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you looked back on that history with the 20th anniversary? Have your thoughts changed on why it happened, why the U.S. intervened in Iraq? What questions do you have for our guest about how presidential and congressional authority work in all this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Drew is with us in Fitchburg. Drew, hello.
Hello. One thing that has always troubled me about presidential war powers is that there is an added incentive to go to war because it polls well. It's more easy to get reelected for a wartime president. They get to look strong, and that is something that Congress doesn't always provide a good check against.
Drew, thanks for the call. I've heard that sometimes, John, but I think of George H.W. Bush and the 91 Gulf War. And then his approval shot right up, and then he lost re-election. Do you have thoughts on the political impact of being a wartime president?
Yeah, no, I think the observation is generally correct in terms of George H.W. Bush, dwindling in popularity. There's an old saying in American politics, I believe, it's the economy stupid, and President George H.W. Bush's reputation as a wartime heroic president couldn't compensate for economic woes. And I think certainly to the Lyndon Baines Johnson administration of a great illustration of Drew's point, and that is when Johnson asked for the what proved to be the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, he did so knowing it was an opportunity for him to look tough. He was a New Deal Democrat, a New Deal Democrat that wanted to push forward his Great Society legislation. He could not afford to look weak on communism. So this was an opportunity for him to rattle the saber, and his popularity skyrocketed in the wake of that. And he won that war power authorization from Congress with a rather overwhelming vote. The same is true in the wake of 9/11. I think that those are different circumstances. You know, what happened in the Gulf of Tonkin in August of 1964 is sort of a sad and sorry tale of misperception leading to escalation, whereas there is absolutely no mistake about what happened on September 11th. But I think there is a general trend in American history, and this is not unique to the United States, when there is a sudden attack on the United States, or in the case of Pearl Harbor, of course, there is the spirit of retribution, which extends across the electorate and is reflected among elected representatives as well, who are quick to authorize the use of military force in the search for justice. But then there's a cooling down period, and wars don't always go the way that they are intended to go, and that enthusiasm wanes. It's interesting to me that the vote for the authorization for use of military force that was just revoked, that was a far more contentious vote, because the decision to invade Iraq was made rather coolly. It was a calculated decision, and it was the subject of much debate at the time. And it was a very, very close vote. And so this is another reason why I think 20 years later, there is a desire to clean up the authorizations and to repeal that authorization, is it is now the general consensus of both the political leaders of this country, as well as, I think, you know, informed citizens and historians, that that war was a great, tragic mistake. Repealing the authorization to launch it doesn't erase that unfortunate history, but at least helps to symbolically close that chapter.
Thanks for that call, Drew, at 800-642-1234. And John, I wanted to talk to you about the changing perception of the Iraq War with the anniversary. People were posting poll results from that time. Now, as you say, there was not by no means universal support. There were protests against the war. But in most demographic groups, there was at least majority support for it. And that seems to have changed a lot. I've seen some polls saying that veterans, even Iraq War veterans in some polls, oppose that war now more than they support it. In hindsight, can you talk about that big change over the last 20 years and how we think about the Iraq War?
Yeah, I don't think you have to look at the entirety of the 20 years for that change to have taken place. I recall watching Colin Powell's performance before the UN Security Council on live television, and myself buying the case hook, line, and sinker, thinking this is beyond any kind of reasonable doubt. Case for weapons of mass destruction is strong. There's a clear and present danger. And I don't know that I came over to being wholly on board with the decision to invade Iraq at the time. When, in fact, I can recall that I was not, but I at least found the argument for doing so compelling at that time. And of course, we soon thereafter discovered that there were no weapons of mass destruction. There was no ongoing campaign being covered up. And Colin Powell himself later regretted that performance and considered it quite justifiably as a stain on a legacy, a lifetime of service to the country.
Do you think we've learned lessons about how and when to go to war based on that experience?
Yes, but if there's one thing that I'm afraid I learned from studying U.S. military history in its full breadth and depth, it's that generations learn lessons, and different generations then have to relearn those lessons. And oftentimes those lessons are too black and white and too simplistic, and it leads to constrained choices the next time an actual crisis confronts the United States, because there are these apparently indisputable truths. History shows that this is the case. For instance, at the end of World War One and the interwar period, history shows us we should not have done that again. And that led to what I would call deliberate unpreparedness for the next challenge that arose. And I think it led to the unnecessary loss of life. So yes, it does impart wisdom, but it's not the wisdom of a historian. Not to sound too proud of my discipline's expertise on any matters, but that's my concern about lessons learned from chapters such as this, is that they're appropriate for a generation at a moment, but they're oftentimes misapplied to different circumstances.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, Ben. My pleasure. Have a great day.
That's John Hall, Associate Professor of U.S. Military History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's a retired U.S. Army Reserve Colonel with past assignments to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and U.S. Central Command, which oversees military operations in the Middle East. We've been looking back at the Iraq War and the use of force authorizations that the U.S. Senate just voted to end with regards to Iraq. What they mean, what it doesn't mean, what changes and what doesn't, if that ends up going to the president's desk and getting signed. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, Wisconsin voters passed two constitutional amendments last week related to bail for people who are awaiting trial. We'll find out what impact those changes could have. And a new report takes a close look at health here in Wisconsin, and it does it one county at a time. Find out where Wisconsin is doing well, both geographically and in the causes of good or poor health, and where there's room for improvement. And as always, you can join the conversation with your thoughts and questions. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday. A Wisconsin chef will help us prepare a Friday night fish fry from our own kitchen with all the sides. First, a new book looks at the long history of medical quackery in the United States and says in many ways, dubious, ineffective, dangerous, and sometimes fraudulent cures are more popular than ever. In the 1920s, John Brinkley told men that they could increase their sexual prowess with a simple $750 surgery, sewing goat testicles to their own nether regions. In the 1950s, a preacher named Charlie Shedd told his followers to pray their weight away. In his new book, our next guest follows modern-day providers of laser treatments, ingested cleaning solutions, pH rebalancing, and other practices that claim to offer the one true cure to everything. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the history and present of dubious medical cures? Are there old remedies and cures you look back on and realize they didn't do much good? Why do you think that often fringe medical ideas gain popularity here in the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Matthew Hungoltz-Hetling is a journalist and author. His latest book is called If It Sounds Like a Quack, A Journey to the Fringes of American Medicine. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. Very, very excited to talk with you today.
Matt, you write in your book that this is not the book you set out to write. What led you down this particular path?
I was writing this book during the early stages and kind of into the peak of the pandemic. And so I thought there were a lot of really interesting public health policy questions being raised right around then. There were questions about government overreach and the extent to which society ought to go to protect the whole from the individuals. And those debates, you'll remember, I'm sure, were really taking center stage as people discussed things like vaccine mandates and workplace mandates for masks and all of that. So I started to reach out to folks who had come into some sort of butted heads with the official policies in some way, shape, or form. And I hope to have a really nuanced discussion with them about, where we ought to draw the line when we weigh the rights of the individual versus the rights of a society to restrict their movements. And when I started to ask some questions about that, what I found instead was that the folks on the fringes of the alternative medicine movement were so had been so radicalized by their life journeys that they didn't really have a lot of nuanced opinion. Their solution was abolish the FDA, abolish the CDC, prevent any government interference whatsoever. And so then my book kind of shifted into who these folks were and how they had become radicalized over the last 20 years. And that really proved to be a very interesting and rewarding journey to go through myself and to take the reader on.
You met people who invented the cure for everything, whether it was lasers or pH balancing, other things. And there's an interesting turning point in their histories for so many of them. They were kind of lone voices in the wilderness selling what they could, when and where they could. And then here comes the internet. How did that change things for the people you followed and the wider fringe of medicine?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, each of them had stumbled upon something that they thought was the one true cure for all disease, right? And medical science tells us that different diseases and medical conditions have discrete causes and therefore discrete cures and treatments. But they were kind of operating on these separate theories of health that they each believe would kind of revolutionize the way we think about medicine in the country today. And so that was what they had in common. Other than that, they had very diverse backgrounds. And before the proliferation of the internet, the only way for them to get their word out to the public was really to go through like the gatekeepers of medical knowledge, whether that was mainstream media or academic medical journals or university programs, things like that. And none of those institutions would give these folks the time of day. Right. And so they were very marginalized. But once the internet allowed folks to reach out to the public more directly, then suddenly those gatekeepers were no longer an effective check on their power to go out and fly their wares to, you know, either consumers or victims, depending on how you look at it. And so that was one major change in the country that brought us to our current state. Another change was that in the 90s, there was the passage of a federal bill that's referred to as the DSHEA, the D-S-H-E-A, that made it much easier for folks to market supplements and other products without having to prove their health and safety and efficacy before getting them onto shelves. And then the final third kind of magic ingredient in all of this was an active effort by the health freedom lobby to go out and court alternative medical practitioners and to tell them that they should reframe the debate away from whether or not their cures were scientifically defensible, and instead that it should be more about the American consumer's right to choose the medical procedure that they wanted, regardless of that procedure, safety and efficacy. And all those things kind of combine to make a real cluster quack.
Talking to Matthew Hungoltz-Hetling, his new book is called If It Sounds Like a Quack, A Journey to the Fringes of American Medicine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Randy is with us in Ripon. Randy, hi.
Hi. You know, this I'm 66, but it reminds me of the old Westerns when the guy came into town with his wagon and his special concoction and drink this. And I know for me in the 70s and 80s, friends were, you know, wear this copper bracelet or a magnet or drink this concoction. You know, there was always something, you know, and of course now with the whole COVID thing, my God, some of the crazy stuff that, but it seems like this has been going on for a long time.
Randy, thanks a lot for the call. And Matt, you write in your book, there is a long tradition here, but it seems to have gotten supercharged, as we were talking about, with the internet and, as Randy mentions, with COVID.
Yeah, Randy's absolutely correct. And there's not a time in American history where there weren't folks out there trying to sell their snake oil and false treatments. And in fact, in the book, one of the topics I touch on is in the 1830s, when a medical freedom movement unfolded that has a lot of parallels to the one that we're in today, in that under the banner of medical freedom, many different healers with many different theories of healing came together and lobbied legislatures to make things easier for the public to buy their services and wares. And they were so effective at that time that they successfully overturned every medical licensing law in the country, so that legally there was no distinction between your university trained medical doctor and your, you know, say, person who wanted to treat people with leeches. And so now I think today those elements are kind of in place again. And if they were to get what they wanted, that would be the same situation we would find ourselves in today.
Thanks for that call, Randy. I want to meet at least one or two of the people you profile in the book. Let's start with the lasers I mentioned and a dentist turned, I guess, inventor, Larry Little, if I'm saying his name right.
Larry Lytle. Yes. Okay. So this guy is a prime example of kind of the life journeys that these folks went on. He was a high school basketball star, a successful dentist, a civic leader in his community in South Dakota, and was really in many ways kind of like an upstanding heroic presence in his community. But then he struck upon this idea that he could harness a universal healing light in his handheld laser devices, and that those devices would allow this light to cure every disease known to man. And he sold these things for like, you know, $12,000, and they had a little remote control, like a television remote control, where you could program in a 3-digit code and wave this device over your kidney, say, and clear out your kidneys, supposedly. And Larry, Dr. Lytle, he was a licensed dentist, he became so convinced of this treatment success that he went out and began selling these lasers for as much as $12,000 a piece, made millions of dollars, mostly selling them to sick and desperate people. And then even when he butted heads with the government, he refused to kind of adjust his path and abandon this idea. Latest chapter of his life is pretty tragic in that, you know, he was eventually arrested and sent to prison while in his 80s. And so this is one of the ironic things is that these stories have a lot of negative consequences, not only for the folks who buy the products, but for the sellers of them as well.
And briefly, with the FDA enforcement process, the FDA doesn't show up and arrest you right away for selling a fraudulent product. There's like, they literally go on for years saying, please stop selling this. Please stop claiming these benefits, right? And this is like an incredibly long process that the people you go through in the book run into when they bump heads with the FDA.
Years and years. And this is one of the lessons that I learned while researching this is that we as a society don't really have a great answer to this one true curism. Like the FDA and other federal authorities and state and local authorities, they'll send you the warning letters. They'll come and do an inspection at your facility and send you, you know, items for correction. And as you say, it goes on for years and years before it enters any sort of criminal justice phase. And then the criminal justice phase is often years and years more. And all the while, the more stubborn of the one true curists, as I call them, just continue to sell their wares or maybe making some sort of token effort toward compliance. By the time they're really enforced against in a very harsh way, their personalities are so consumed. You know, their self-identity is that they are a healer with a revolutionary medical idea that they're being persecuted for. And they're so, and plus they're making, you know, in some cases, millions of dollars from these products. And so even when they go to prison, they tend to not show remorse There was a fellow that I spoke to who was in a Colombian prison awaiting extradition. And he told me that he had, while in jail, treated, you know, 20 or 30 of the other inmates in this facility while awaiting criminal to face his criminal charges for doing that same thing. So it's very, very difficult for us to wrangle with this problem as a society. We really have to go upstream and nip it in the bud somehow.
Talking to Matt Hungold-Tetling about his new book, If It Sounds Like a Quack, A Journey to the Fringes of American Medicine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about some of the fringe remedies that he's been writing about, maybe that you've encountered in your personal life or hearing about it from others? Why do you think things on the fringe are popular? How about the middle ground? Maybe it's not something you'd encounter in a doctor's office, but it's sold on that supplement shelf. Call 800-642-1234. We'll hear more of your thoughts coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Matt Hungold-Tetling about his new book. It's called If It Sounds Like a Quack, A Journey to the Fringes of American Medicine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. I'd just like to say a happy Easter to you and all your listeners. So my question for your guest is, I take echinacea from time to time. I'll take St. John's wort, occasionally melatonin. And on a lot of these products on the side of the bottle, it says that these claims have not been evaluated by the FDA, yet these products have been sold for quite a long time. And they've been, I mean, these are prescriptions or remedies that have been prescribed in the past, going back to ancient China, thousands of years in India. I mean, it's in the Ayurvedic medicine. So I feel like the fact that some of these things have been around for so long, even though they haven't been evaluated, that there's still some sort of efficacy and value to it.
Marcus, thanks a lot for the call. And Matt, when you're writing about fringe, I think you're definitely talking about things way fringier than the supplements Marcus is talking about. And also that statement he mentioned on a label, it might say supports immune system health or something, asterisk, not evaluated by the FDA. That's okay under the law. Could you talk about Marcus's comments?
Yeah, Marcus, I'm definitely not on the attack against anyone who takes any sort of supplement. If I was, I think I'd be criticizing virtually the entire country. But I will tell you that you as a consumer are left with a higher burden of responsibility for those supplements that you go out and you purchase from someone who's making money off of that product and who's operating under the same business model that other folks are without some of the oversight and regulations that you would see in other industries. And so, for example, some of the folks that I talked to who are in the supplements industry, they sold what they thought were perfectly good remedies in good faith to their customers. But then they would find out that somewhere back along the supply chain, someone was lying to them. And in fact, some of the herbal supplements can have the ones that are intended to produce more eye-popping effects actually contain illegal amounts of the very same pharmaceuticals that someone who's favoring an all-natural approach might be trying to avoid. And so I urge you, Marcus, to please learn what you can about the supply chain of that. And then just to respond to the other point really quickly, the fact of a long-standing tradition around a particular effect is the sort of thing that typically generates scientific interest and study of a possible remedy. And if it meets those standards and tests, they're typically incorporated into the practices of best evidence. And if they're not, then they're not. The fact that something's been used for a long time is less of a selling point than you might imagine.
Thanks a lot for that call, Marcus, at 800-642-1234. Something I want to bring up before we run out of time here, Matt, it would be easy to write a book like this in kind of a mocking tone toward these practitioners and the people who buy things. I feel like you really don't do that in the book. You're very sympathetic. I want to focus in on the people who might buy these products to people who feel like our medical system has let them down, unequal access, expensive care, people not being listened to. You are sympathetic, I think, to people's desire to believe that there's a one true cure out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think all of us humans are fairly silly in our own way. We all have flaws of reason. I certainly see pieces of myself in these folks who have stumbled down these very wrong life paths. And I think that is how we ought to think of them rather than as real enemies of the public health. You know, the fact is that they're in some ways victims of their own delusions. And the real problem is that this has bred, you know, immense distrust of the whole medical scientific establishment, in part because that establishment is very flawed. Certainly medical science has some skeletons in its closet and a bad track record in some ways. But at the end of the day, it's the best tool we have for measuring whether or not a procedure or a practice is effective. It's responsible for having extended human life expectancy dramatically over the last 100 years. And, you know, it's a shame that faith in these institutions is declining so rapidly. You know, 20 years ago, vaccines were more popular, according to public surveys, than Dolly Parton, if you can believe that. Today, we have hundreds of millions of Americans who distrust medical science in general, and tens of millions of Americans who, you know, during this most recent pandemic, had been led to believe that the establishment was so corrupt that vaccines were worthless. And that costs, of course, many people their lives.
Time for one more caller. Victoria is with us in Whitewater. Victoria, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Victoria?
Well, thanks for taking my call. Yes, I wanted to know. I have a cousin who's constantly calling me and asking me to research this product or that product. And many times they are Oprah Winfrey endorsed products, such as her weight loss gummies. And what does he, you know, I usually tell her if it really worked, everybody would be using them. But is that really true? Because if it takes a long time for the FDA to approve things,
I think your cousin has the right instinct in that she's reaching out to someone looking for advice, and you are that trusted source for her. So I think, all you can do is try to turn to the folks that you trust in who have perhaps, you know, more of a professional skill in evaluating these sorts of medical claims. I think when I see a media personality like Oprah Winfrey, like Alex Jones, selling products and making millions of dollars without seemingly a high degree of regard for the efficacy of those products, I think it's really sad, you know. And I think we need a system that doesn't create such a financial incentive to do this. You know, what one thing that I found in the study is that there's a higher risk reward benefit to selling illegal pharmaceuticals than there is to selling cocaine. You know, it's like 32 times more profitable to sell a pharmaceutical drug illegally than it is cocaine. And so, of course, bad actors are going to come out of the woodwork and take advantage of all that free space and free reign that they've been given.
Victoria, thanks for the call. And Matt, thanks for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
That's Matthew Hungoltz-Hetling, journalist and author. His new book is If It Sounds Like a Quack, A Journey to the Fringes of American Medicine. Coming up, it's Food Friday, and we're going to try making some fish fry at home. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.